97.7 Dundalk FM
Town Talk.
Now, at the weekend, I was watching a film called The Imitation Game. A great film, absolutely great film, and I was reading about it afterwards. It won lots of awards. It starred Benedict Cumberbatch, and Keira Knightley was in it as well. And Benedict took the role, the lead role of Alan Turing, who was a maths genius and a code breaker for the British during World War II. And he was breaking the Nazi code Enigma, and he got great success. But then I decided to Google him, and I found two things. First of all, he has an Irish connection. And the second thing was that our science correspondent, Sean Duke, is a bit of an expert on Alan Turing. So I said, Sean, who's on the line, I hope, Sean, we'll talk about Alan Turing and the imitation game. Sean, you're very welcome as ever.
Hi, Pat. Good morning.
Good morning to you. You obviously have an interest in Alan Turing because, like myself, I'm sure you've watched the film and you've read the book that it was based on. But tell me, first of all, Alan Turing, the Nazi codebreaker, had an Irish connection. What was the Irish connection?
He sure did. He had a very strong Irish connection. There's a family in Dublin, an Anglo-Irish family called Stoney. And people in Dublin or that know Dublin will know that in Dundrum there's a road, for example, called Stoney Road. And that's after a relative of Turing, because his mother was an Ethel Stoney. George Stoney was a scientist who invented the term electron, and the road in Dundrum is named after him. And there's a whole load of Stoneys that are quite famous as scientists. There was another guy, Bindon Blood Stoney, really exotic name. He was the engineer of Dublin Port. He built the Liffey Quays. There were a few others. There was a George Fitzgerald who was raised at Stoney's. He actually contributed, believe it or not, to Einstein's theory of relativity. So these were really top-notch people. His mother, Ethel, her father was the chief engineer of the Madras Railways. This is going back to British colonial days. So there was a huge scientific connection on the mother's side. Now, she actually married a guy called Julius Turing, and that's the English connection, if you like. But he was a member of the Indian Civil Service, and there doesn't seem to be much academic stuff going on there at all. They were into fly fishing and this and that, but no, it seems you could make a very strong case that really his genius came from Ireland.
So the Irish genes were genius.
Yes, absolutely. Now, Ethel, anyway, just to continue the Irish connection, she grew up in Tipperary at Longford, so there's a connection there with Alan Turing. And then the family, they were in Clare, County Clare, for a while. And then they moved to Dublin in 1891 to put a year on it. And she was educated at a well-known school here on the south side of Dublin, Alexandra College Girls' School. It's a private girls' school. It was set up at a time when, you know, girls were being encouraged in this school, which was very unusual, to have their own education and career, etc., at a time when they weren't, you know, they weren't really in the workplace at all. So she was a very clever woman, apparently, in her own right. But then at a certain stage in those days, what happened with the Anglo-Irish, as people might know, is that the girls then went to, I forget the term on it, but they kind of came out, I think.
Finishing school or something, was it?
Yeah, debutantes and that kind
of thing.
So basically they were sent to London where they would meet eligible bachelors. And she met Julius Turing there, this guy who was in the Indian Civil Service. And they decided to get married. And they married in St. Bartholomew's Church, which is in Ballsbridge in Dublin 4, in 1907. There's another Irish connection.
Wow. So there's a strong Irish connection right the way through, particularly from his mother's side. Take me back to the start when Turing was a young fellow. I mean, we know, well, from watching the film, he was an absolute genius and did wonderful things. And in many ways, his legacy lives still today. But did he show that genius at school? What was he like when he was a young guy?
Yeah, he was quite eccentric. You know, he was quiet. He had a friend, if you like to call it, a Christopher. He was in a public school. They were pretty well off. And he, it seems like he had feelings for this chap, Christopher. He didn't really understand it maybe at the time. Turing, as we know, was gay at a time when it was difficult to be gay. So
it was illegal. It was illegal.
It was illegal up until, well, the 50s, I think it was still illegal. But in any case, this is going way back. He was born in 1912. So, yeah, he was a bit of an oddball. But he was a genius. Christopher, his friend, died, which was a tragic thing mentioned in the film, which was devastating to him. And I think it was a kind of a slow realization maybe that he was gay. But in any case, he went to university, went to Cambridge, and he was elected a fellow, which is a big deal, at Cambridge at the age of just 22, which so it shows you that the chap was really a genius. Mm-hmm. At the age of 24, so this is just before World War II, he came up with this idea of a universal machine, which was absolutely genius breakthrough at the time, 1936. This idea that a machine could potentially solve all problems. So the only machines to do calculations at that time were very crude kind of mechanical machines, not like the electronic supercomputers we have today. They could just do one job at a time and mm-hmm. pretty slowly. He thought, he put this theory out there, that a machine could solve any potential problem. And it was like a challenge that was laid down to the community. So, of course, when war came, he was recruited secretly. By a lot of the young guys, mainly guys, some women, not many, were recruited into Bletchley Park to tackle these German codes. And, you know, they were all quite young. He was a team leader, even though he was only 24, 25. A lot of them were even younger than him. And he did remarkable things there during World War II, which we can talk about if you like.
And the film, just when it comes to Bletchley Park, where all these young, clever people were brought together to sort of crack the codes of the Nazi, he had a peculiar way of recruiting his people. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it? Well, according to the film, you might know better, but he had a peculiar way of recruiting people into the Bletchley Park team.
To be honest, I forget that part of the film.
I think it was to do with crosswords.
Oh, crosswords, yes. Yeah. See, a lot of them were very good at crosswords. A lot of them were very good at chess. In those days, if you were good at problem solving in terms of puzzles, they also got language experts. You know, they were the type of people that were recruited in. If they could solve these basic problems, they were brought in. And it was pretty clear anyway as well. I think Turing himself, they would have been approached. The way they did it, I think, was that the British Secret Service basically went to Oxford and Cambridge, the dons there, mathematics and maybe philosophy, and they said, listen, do you have any really bright students? Would they be interested in working in the national interest? And then an approach was made on that basis, and they didn't really know more than that. And of course, it was kind of an offer you couldn't refuse, because there were a few cases of people who just copped on that this is something to do with the war, and they didn't want to be involved on a conscientious basis. Mm. Their careers were really destroyed, so most people had to join, and Turing did. And what he did there was absolutely remarkable, and it's laid out in the film.
And the code that they were trying to break was called Enigma, and it was unbreakable, but he managed to break it with the friend of Christopher the Machine.
Yes, Christopher the Machine, yes. So essentially, this Enigma, for those that might have seen the film or didn't see the film, this was the code that was used by the German Navy, essentially, for U-boats, to communicate with U-boats from shore and to move them around. And this was critical because at that time, early in the war, the U-boats were devastating the traffic that was going between the United States and Britain. This was the supply line. This was keeping Britain alive. Without that, they were in serious trouble. So it was essential that they tap into or break the code that was used by the subs to communicate with each other. So they did get a bit of luck in that they found a machine, this Enigma machine, which was on a sub that sank, and they used that then to try and infer what kind of code would be produced by this machine. And to do that, then they built their own machine at Bletchley Park, which was full of valves and tubes and lights, and you can see that in the film. And essentially, it was a computer. It was a very early computer. And the way it worked, the problem they had was that everything was done on pen and paper in those days by code breakers. But the Germans had this code, and the code changed. So they essentially had a 24 or 48-hour window to crack the code before it changed and moved again. So there was a speed element. They probably could have broken it if they were given long enough, like 50 years by hand, but that wasn't possible. They didn't have the time. So something had to be done. They came up with this machine, and essentially what the machine did was it worked by elimination. So it ran through immense possibilities based on the information that they had, and essentially arrived at the only possible answer that it could be, because all the other answers were impossible. And so they adjusted this, and they got it going faster. And then they really had something they could work with. They were able to break this code, and they were able to intercept the U-boats and deal with the U-boat menace.
Absolutely fascinating. And obviously, it was probably in many ways a turn of the war for the Allies.
It did. Absolutely, it did. Well, it certainly, it meant that Britain was going to survive at that time, yeah, when it was really under pressure with in 1940-41. It kept them going in the war. There were other codes that were really important too. I mean, this was just a naval code enigma. There were other codes that were used by the German army, which is another story altogether, which I'm researching actually. But yes, they reckon that it could have shortened the war by maybe a year or 2 years, what he did. So millions of lives were saved by this.
And we'll come back to his personal life, because that was in many ways tragic. But in terms of his scientific legacy, what can you say about him?
His legacy is absolutely enormous. I mean, he really, if you're looking for a figure that's the father of computers, or the world we live in, our phones, everything we do today, I don't think you can think of a more influential figure than Alan Turing. I mean, he if he was around today, he would be involved at the cutting edge of quantum computing, next generation computing. No doubt about that. He was way ahead of his time. Essentially, as I said before, he came up with this idea that a machine, a calculating machine, which became known as a computer, could solve more than one problem at once. And that he developed a thing called an algorithm, which is, we know what they are now, which is essentially a step-by-step procedure for solving a problem. And that it could replicate the human mind, or even surpass the human mind. And these were revolutionary ideas at the time. And he put the theory out there, and then he showed during the war that he could actually do it, that a machine could be developed that was much faster, much more accurate than humans. And then it was a case of, could this replace humans altogether? And he was thinking, he came out with a paper in 1950, which is more than half a century ago, which was famous at the time. He said, can machines think? So this, I mean, at that time, that was amazing, because it was so radical. Even now we're debating that, whether there's a school of thought that says machines will eventually become conscious, like you and me. They'll know they exist. And others say, no, that'll never happen. But Turing put the question out in 1950. And there's another thing then, that based on this, there's something that we still use today called a Turing test. And you'll know that when you're talking sometimes online, you'll be talking to an artificial intelligence, not a human.
Yes.
And they're getting better. It's getting harder to actually, sometimes when you're talking, am I talking to a human, or am I talking to some synthetic AI creature? So that's called the Turing test. And if you are able to judge that actually that's synthetic, then it fails the Turing test. But of course, we're getting to the stage where these things are going to pass the Turing test. And we won't know very soon, I'm sure, when we're talking. Are we talking to a human, or are we talking to something synthetic?
Well, we're definitely human, Sean. Definitely.
We're human anyway. Just a huge figure.
Despite his brilliance and his legacy, he didn't really get the sort of recognition he deserved in his lifetime. And in fact, quite the opposite. He ended up, because, as you say, he was gay and it was illegal, he ended up being arrested. And can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was very sad, because after the war then, of course, he was still a young guy, and he started working then in Manchester University. And he had a vision, of course, that he wanted to develop an electronic computer. And they'd already developed a kind of a rudimentary electronic computer during the war, which was top secret. So you have to remember the politics at the time. So the Nazis had been defeated. But even towards the end of World War II, the British and the Americans were thinking about the threat from the Soviet Union. So, almost immediately after the end of World War II, there was a new threat on the rise in the Soviet Union, and the Cold War came very quickly. So that meant that really there was an atmosphere of secrecy, and that really he knew too much, if you like. He knew exactly where the bodies were buried. And then you had spies who were looking and analyzing, who knows about these electronic computers, because the British were way ahead of everybody else. And they were looking for security risks. And somebody decided that because Turing was gay, that, the Soviets could perhaps, he could be compromised, basically, that he could be trapped in some situation where the Soviets would threaten to out him if he didn't hand over intelligence, that kind of thing. So he became a security risk in the eyes of the British intelligence. So he was out. He essentially was out of the scene, and he wasn't. He resented that. He never said it publicly, but he was sidelined, and that really hurt him. And of course, going into the 50s, then the early 50s, the Cold War ramped up, and he was out of the loop. So that was a problem for him. And then, of course, it was sad that in those days, you know, men in England had to meet each other in public toilets and all kinds of sordid stuff like that. So that was the life he was leading. And I think a combination of finding it difficult to cope with that, and also not being able to do the science that he really loved because he was cut out and he was a security risk, actually led to, you know, I'm just guessing now, you never know exactly, of course, but that seems to be the background to his suicide in 1954, where he was found by his cleaner. She came in, and there was a half-eaten apple, very kind of dramatic ending, with cyanide on it. And if you, you know, we all know that apple, the symbol for apple is this half-eaten apple. And that seems to be a nod to Alan Turing and his legacy. And the reason he did it, apparently, or that one theory is that his mum, as we mentioned before, was very scientific. So if he had this half-eaten apple with cyanide on it, that he gave her a way to think that it wasn't suicide, that actually he had been using cyanide in an experiment of some sort and had randomly got some on his fingers, and that he didn't mean to do it.
Isn't it lovely that in his dying moments he was thinking about how his mum was going to feel and come up with that idea?
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, the British, of course, realised only fairly recently that the huge contribution he made to them surviving and then eventually winning the war with the help of the other allies, and how badly, how absolutely awfully he was treated at the time. And you can see all of this in the film. And the film is as you've seen it, Pat, it's really good. And
It's a great film, and it's very enjoyable. And I'll never look at my Apple computer again without thinking of Alan Turing, I have to say, Sean. But thanks to you. Sean, we're going to have to leave it at that as ever, but fascinating stuff. And Sean, if somebody wants to hear more and see more of what you do, where do they go?
Yeah, I've got a blog called Science Spinning, and they can check out my stuff on there.
Wonderful stuff. Thank you very much, Sean Duke from Science Spinning. All the best, Sean. Thank you.
Thanks.
97.7 Dundalk FM. Town Talk.